Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment, the concluding segment of a seven-part series, we're going to continue our examination of the assassination of Martin Luther King. And as in our previous six segments, we're going to rely for our information on a marvelous new book, new anyway, as of the late summer and early fall of 1995 when I'm recording this. This book is entitled Orders to Kill, subtitled The Truth Behind the Murder of Martin Luther King. That's authored by William F. Pepper and published in hardcover by Carolyn Graff, copyright 1995. William F. Pepper is the co-counsel for James Earl Ray, the patsy for the assassination of Martin Luther King, and he's described on the inside flap as, quote, a barrister in England, a U.S. attorney, and an associate of the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators. He practices international human rights and constitutional law from London, has represented governments and heads of state, and appeared as an expert on international law issues. He has published two other books and various articles. In this concluding segment of our series, we're going to present information about the cover-up of the assassination of Martin Luther King and some of the curious things, curious is a euphemism here, that have befallen James Earl Ray since the time that he was fingered officially as the assassin of Martin Luther King, which he most assuredly was not. In our previous six segments, we have been detailing the two main components of the conspiracy to assassinate Martin Luther King, a conspiracy that was hatched from the highest levels of the corridors of power in the United States. The powers that be were afraid that the combining of the American Civil Rights Movement with elements of the anti-Vietnam War movement might very well lead to some profound social change in this country. And in fact, there were fears that perhaps the anti-war movement and civil rights movement were foreign/communist directed, and that this could lead to a violent revolution or civil war in the United States. Fears that I don't think were in any size, shape, form, or manner grounded in fact. However, it should be noted these were very real fears on the part of many people in power in the United States in the mid and late 1960s. We have taken a look at the, quote, civilian, unquote, aspect of the conspiracy and organized crime contract to assassinate Martin Luther King that originated with the South and Southwest organized crime empire of Carlos Marcello, capo mafioso for New Orleans. Marcello, in turn, utilized organized crime contacts in Memphis, and it appears that the actual shooter may very well have been an individual named Raul, James Earl Ray's handler, who had dealings with the Marcello organization. Also a fellow named Frank C. Liberto, a Memphis organized crime functionary, utilizing a gambling associate named Lloyd Jowers. We have detailed these connections in the first six segments of this series. Also, backing up the civilian sniper was a Green Beret team, an eight-man Alpha 184 team from the 20th Special Forces Group, based in Birmingham, Alabama, operating out of Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and operating under the auspices of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group. In Orders to Kill, William F. Pepper goes on to assess the two halves of the conspiracy, saying, obviously, it is too much of a coincidence for the Alpha 184 Army snipers and the, quote, civilian, unquote, assassin to have been there independently taking aim at Dr. King at the same moment. The whole arrangement, the manipulation of Martin Luther King into the exposed balcony room, the stripping away of security and potential witnesses who could not be controlled, the provision of a patsy, the positioning of massive surveillance and a sniper team, the provision of local intelligence and logistical assistance, the restriction of the investigation by FBI control, the ignoring of leads and evidence begging for attention, the alteration of the scene of the crime could only have been possible with the knowledge and cooperation of the FBI, Army Intelligence, the Army Security Agency, the 20th Special Forces Group, elements of the Army Chief of Staff for Intelligence's Office, the CIA, the mob, and senior officers of the Memphis Police Department. Further, we know from Warren's orders that the White House, the Secretary of Defense, the FBI, and officials of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, among others, were aware of the Memphis Army deployment. By the way, Warren is the pseudonym for a living member of the Alpha 184 team, currently out of the country because of fear for his life. Continuing, the relationship between the Army and the civilian assassination operations is further revealed by James's use of the alias of Eric S. Galt. Galt, G-A-L-T, holding top security clearance, was at the time involved in another covert operation, Project Mexpo, with the same unit, the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, which carried out the Memphis deployment and coordinated the 111th Military Intelligence Group, Army Security Agency, and 20th Special Forces Group forces on site. In fact, Gardner of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group himself selected the 8-man Alpha 184 sniper team. It clearly appears that the hit was to be carried out by the civilian contract killer with the Army snipers there as backup shooters if the contract shooter could not make the shot or if he failed to kill King. How two snipers shooting from different locations could take out both King and Young and still pin the shooting on James Earl Ray is difficult to reconcile until one remembers that the initial plan appeared to be to shoot at a moving target in a car. Because of the movement of the car and the fact that bullets would be deflected back and forth inside, it would be virtually impossible to determine the origin of the shots. The Army snipers were surprised that their targets, Dr. King and Andy Young, were outside of their rooms in exposed positions just before 6 p.m. Not believing their luck, they quickly got them in their sights and waited for the order to fire. They were amazed when this did not come. While particular senior-level officials must have been aware of the whole picture, the lower-level participants only knew what their particular roles were. Thus, the Army snipers knew nothing of the local subcontract, and Warren assumed when King was shot that it was one of their snipers who had fired too early. Similarly, the civilian operatives were unlikely to have known about the military presence. Even if the fiction of the lone assassin James Earl Ray could not be sustained, there was, at the next level, already in place, an officially deniable local contract and assassination operation ostensibly carried out exclusively by organized crime. As to organized crime, the mob would not be involved without being paid, though it appears that the payment was organized from official sources, unvouchered, and thus untraceable funds would have been used. In one sense, the killing itself was the easy part. The difficulty in such operations is how to cover up the truth and keep it covered up so that the official involvement does not surface. In order to accomplish this, strict control must be exercised over any investigation. Such control characterized the original FBI-directed Memphis Police Department investigation and the subsequent Justice Department and House Select Committee on Assassination investigations. It is important to realize that much of the subsequent cover-up activity took place after a number of key officials in 1967 and 68 had gone from the scene. Director Hoover died in 1972. Lyndon Johnson did not run for re-election and died in 1973. H.L. Hunt passed away in 1974, and by then Richard Helms, Army Chief of Staff General Harold Johnson, and Army Chief of Staff for Intelligence General William Yarborough were long gone from the official positions they held at the time. Gardner faded away and eventually disappeared. Finally, in the years following the events of April 4, 1968, two members of the Alpha 184 team, Captain Billy Idson and Second Lieutenant Robert Worley, died or were killed, leaving Warren and Murphy in no doubt that a cleanup operation was underway. They left the country. A third member, the Central Communications Operator, also went into hiding in Canada, and a fourth, J.D., was also killed some years later. The exception, however, was outside of government, where Carlos Marcello, though in prison for part of the time, remained active in running his New Orleans criminal enterprise, and the same Memphis godfather continued to be his main man in Memphis. Produce man Frank C. Liberto also continued to, quote, take care of business, unquote, in that city with the godfather's blessing until he died in 1978, the year he admitted his role in the killing to the Whitlocks. The point is that insofar as the government is concerned, the personalities, heinous though many of them were, changed, but a consistent policy of covering up the truth by the use of every possible means, including further murders, was continued. In every sense, the cover-up has been institutionalized, and it is not dependent upon the actions of particular individuals who were involved and determined to protect themselves. James Earl Ray abandoned the Eric S. Galt alias, and, after going from Atlanta to Canada, fled to England using the name Raymond George Snyd, S-N-E-Y-D. Media coverage, often using FBI-planted stories, generally depicted him as a racist, violent, cold-blooded killer who had dealt in and used drugs. This coverage would continue beyond his conviction. The public image of James was not the only one being molded by the mass media. It would also consistently record and remember Dr. King's pre-1996 Southern civil rights work, ignoring his formidable commitment to end the war and economic injustice at home. James was ultimately arrested on June 8th, extradited to the United States on July 19th, arriving in Memphis around 3 a.m. Only hours before, when tipped off about Ray's return, Memphis produce man Frank Liberto flew to Detroit. After James's capture, all FBI work on the case ceased. At no time in the pretrial period or since was the defense allowed to test the rifle or the bullets in evidence. James found himself housed in oppressive conditions, with his lawyers, first the Haineses and then Percy Forman, being paid pursuant to a contract with an author who he gradually came to believe was providing information to the FBI. James would eventually be coerced into pleading guilty by his second lawyer, Percy Forman. It finally emerged that at least by 1977-78, Forman apparently knew Raoul and had no doubt that his former client was innocent. We will talk about Percy Forman, incidentally, formerly at one point an attorney for Jack Ruby, the man who killed Lee Harvey Oswald, the patsy in the assassination of President Kennedy. We're going to talk about Percy Forman and his certain awareness that James Earl Ray was innocent in just a few minutes. What we're going to do next is to take a look at some of the steps that were taken to see to it that the assassination of Martin Luther King was covered up. One of those steps appears to have been a number of attempts to kill James Earl Ray. In particular, while the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation was underway, eventually it became apparent to those who sought to silence James Earl Ray that in order to protect his life, he himself was maintaining a discreet silence about some of the details concerning his being trafficked around. By the way, in order to flesh out all of the details concerning the assassination of Martin Luther King, I strongly recommend that interested listeners pick up the book Orders to Kill by William F. Pepper. And beyond that, I recommend that they obtain Radio Free America program number 8 from Archives on Audio, about which I will have more to say in a couple of minutes or later in this broadcast. Of the various attempts to silence James Earl Ray, there were a number of attempts to kill him involving organized crime and elements of the FBI and national security establishment. The author William F. Pepper writes as follows. Bear in mind that these attempts crested during the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation. Recall also that information was provided to William F. Pepper by the Alpha Team 184 member, who is presented under the pseudonym of Warren, that James Earl Ray was never to have survived. He was to have been killed either in Memphis or later on in Africa, his ultimate destination. He did, however, survive, so subsequent attempts were made to silence him. Those attempts are described by William F. Pepper as follows. During the time that the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation was in operation, there was a series of efforts to silence James Earl Ray prior to his testifying in public in August of 1978. It is important to note that there have been efforts to silence James at critical times during the history of the case. James Earl Ray was supposed to have been killed before he could be captured. One official source, Herbert, said that the reason the Galt alias and its tie to the 902nd Military Intelligence Group was never considered a problem was because James was to have been killed either in Memphis or in Africa. I was incorrect a moment ago. The individual who is called Warren was not the individual who provided this information. Rather, it was another member of the team, another military intelligence operative who is presented under the pseudonym of Herbert here, who provided that information to Pepper. Continuing, repeating the last sentence, one official source, Herbert, said that the reason the Galt alias and its tie to the 902nd Military Intelligence Group was never considered a problem was because James was to have been killed, either in Memphis or in Africa. There would obviously have been concern in official circles about what James might testify to at his trial. This was taken care of by the orchestration of his guilty plea. Then, in June of 1977, James escaped with others from Brushy Mountain Penitentiary, and all the indications are that he was not supposed to return alive. He was no sooner over the wall, the nearest guard tower was curiously unmanned at the time, and into the hills behind the prison, when a large SWAT team, upwards of 30 FBI snipers, took up position in the area. The function of snipers is not to apprehend. It is to kill. On the day of the escape, Governor Ray Blanton received a call from House Select Committee on Assassinations Chairman Lewis Stokes, who told him that House Select Committee on Assassination staff believed that the FBI went to the area with instructions to kill James. The governor immediately went to the prison and ordered the agents to leave. Some years later, when the federal agents controlling Arthur Baldwin discussed Ray with him, Baldwin said they made it clear that on that occasion James was not meant to be brought back alive. By the way, Arthur Baldwin was a nightclub owner with connections to organized crime who had been recruited a couple of different times, or was aware of a couple of different occasions James Earl Ray was to have been killed. In fact, he himself was to have been involved in at least one of those attempts. Continuing. The escape, Baldwin understood, was staged for the purpose of killing James and putting an end to the problem. James's luck held up once again. He was actually captured by a prison guard. The plan failed. The next attempt to close the case once and for all by eliminating James arose in the autumn of 1977. The mafia godfather in Memphis told Art Baldwin that if he, Baldwin, could clean up the problem, he would be very amply rewarded. He told him that the people in New Orleans found Ray's continued visibility worrying. They wanted the problem to be over. The godfather felt an obligation because the, quote, screw-up, unquote, happened in his town and area of responsibility. Baldwin approached Tim Kirk, with whom he said he had worked on some other matters. They met and discussed the problem, but it went no further. Some months later, in June of 1978, Baldwin spoke by telephone with Kirk, who by then was in the Shelby County Jail. Though Baldwin was offered $50,000 to get the job done, he told Kirk that the contract price was $5,000. Kirk became suspicious because of Baldwin's known ties to federal agents, and let James's lawyers in on the plot. If Kirk knew that the godfather had put out the contract, he never let on. The third and final attempt, of course, involved an offer made to Baldwin by his FBI control agent some 6 or 7 months after the godfather's approach. It was first set out during a car journey to Nashville, and Baldwin subsequently overheard it being discussed by agents involved in the prosecution of Governor Ray Blanton. Baldwin backed off, because he could not get satisfactory immunity from all prosecution. Baldwin backed off because he could not get satisfactory answers to material questions. Though promised lifelong immunity from all prosecution, Baldwin increasingly began to suspect that he, and possibly the other person who would be working with him, would not survive the operation. In 1980, Cheryl and Bob, following the advice of Houston attorney Percy Foreman, who seemed to know Raul and in fear for their lives, left Houston and resettled in another state where Bob had family. Bob and Cheryl were operatives in some of the organized crime operations that were being directed by the Marcello organization, and they apparently were aware of Raul's apparent participation in this particular plot. And also, according to Cheryl, again an associate of the organized crime milieu that was involved in the civilian end of the conspiracy, Cheryl apparently, while being pursued by Percy Foreman, one of James Earl Ray's attorneys, gained information that in the first place, Percy Foreman knew that James Earl Ray was innocent, but that he apparently had to, quote, be sacrificed, unquote. And later, as indicated, Cheryl and Bob feared for their lives and may very well have been the focus of an attempt on their lives as well. Again, Cheryl and Bob, Cheryl in particular, involved in some of the machinations of the organized crime milieu involved in the, quote, civilian, unquote, end of the conspiracy. We dealt with Percy Foreman, by the way, in the aforementioned Radio Free America program number 8, available from archives on audio. Of Percy Foreman and his apparent acquaintance with Raul, James Earl Ray's handler, and his apparent awareness that James Earl Ray was innocent, the author writes as follows. Of Cheryl, he says, after a while, she learned that Foreman had been James Earl Ray's lawyer. He told her that one day, white Americans would learn that Ray was a, quote, sacrifice, unquote, or had to be, quote, sacrificed, unquote, for their welfare. He even told her that he knew Ray was innocent, but that it didn't matter. Cheryl, who had been harboring the terrible secret about who she really believed killed Dr. King, decided finally to unburden herself. she told Foreman. Shortly afterward, Foreman informed her that he had spoken with Raul Pereira. By the way, Pereira also is a pseudonym. To her horror, he appeared to have known him for some time. Thereafter, Foreman called her at home several times a week to talk to her about Raul and tell her to be careful. She had the impression that he spoke regularly with Raul and was trying to take advantage of her plight to get her into bed. She was afraid of alienating him, but wasn't interested and tried to keep her distance. Finally, at one point in 1979, Foreman told her in no uncertain terms that if she and Bob did not leave Houston, they would be dead within the year. They prepared to leave and put their house up for sale. In a matter of weeks, Cheryl was driving on the expressway and a wheel simply fell off her car, nearly causing her to be annihilated by an 18-wheel tractor trailer. She believed this was no accident because every one of the lug nuts came off. Since Bob regularly serviced the car and checked the wheels, the lug nuts must have been deliberately loosened. They left, only returning to sell their house, and in 1981, resettled in their present home. By the way, James Earl Ray, Percy Foreman, rather, in addition to being James Earl Ray's attorney, was at one point an attorney for Jack Ruby, the individual who killed Lee Harvey Oswald. In a number of broadcasts, including The Guns of November, Part 4, and also in Radio Free America, Number 9, among others, we dealt with the many evidentiary tributaries running between the various American political assassinations and attempted assassinations. I refer interested listeners to those archive shows for the complete information in that particular regard. In segment number 5 in this series, we took a look at indications that some of the people involved in the background, at any rate, in the assassination of Martin Luther King were also aware of the impending assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Still another evidentiary tributary running between the assassination of Martin Luther King and another major American political assassination, in this case the assassination of President Kennedy, is relayed as follows, or is related, I should say, as follows by William F. Pepper. In describing a trip made by James Earl Ray along with an acquaintance named Charles Stein, this trip was made from Los Angeles to New Orleans. The author William F. Pepper describes a meeting that James Earl Ray had with Raul, his contact and an employee of the Carlos Marcello organization. This meeting apparently took place in the International Trade Mart in New Orleans, which was being run by Clay Shaw, the focus of Jim Garrison's investigation. Jim Garrison, of course, the New Orleans DA, who first tried to prosecute David Ferry, and then later, when David Ferry died under strained circumstances, he focused his prosecutorial efforts on Clay Shaw. Of course, the Garrison investigation, the major focus of the movie JFK, the much pilloried, but I think excellent and very heroic effort by Oliver Stone. Of the apparent presence of James Earl Ray in the International Trade Mart in New Orleans, the author writes as follows. Again, Charlie Stein, an associate of James Earl Ray on a trip from Los Angeles to New Orleans. I found Charlie Stein in a rehabilitation hospital and interviewed him at length. A stroke had affected his memory, but he was clear about certain things. James, whom he had known as Eric Galt, was no racist. He got along well with blacks, particularly with black women. On the trip from Los Angeles to New Orleans, James did make a telephone call to the people, quote, contractors, unquote, or, quote, engineers, unquote, he was to meet in New Orleans, but Stein did not observe the number he dialed. One evening in New Orleans, James told him that while he, James, was in a meeting in a bar in Lower Canal Street, Le Bunny Lounge, he saw Stein pass by and wanted to call to him, but the person with him, presumably Raul, did not want to be seen, and so he did not call out. Stein said he believed that James went to a meeting in a huge building at the end of Canal Street, and that he also met with some people from Gentilly Road, that's Gentilly. He believed that James told him about this activity, but he really wasn't certain how he learned about it. I next spent some hours going through the New Orleans street directory in the public library, and despite a brownout which interrupted the work, I learned that the big building Charlie Stein was talking about could only have been the International Trade Mart, which in 1967 was still run by none other than Clay Shaw, the longtime CIA asset prosecuted by Jim Garrison for conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy. I noted the names and telephone numbers of a number of the tenant companies. Right around the corner from the Trademart were the offices of the Buck Cries Machine Company, whose vice president and general manager was Salvatore J. Liberto. By the way, Salvatore Liberto, the brother of James Liberto, the Memphis organized crime functionary and lieutenant of Carlos Marcello, who basically was the administrator for the Memphis end of the civilian end of the conspiracy. By the way, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, as badly curtailed as its investigation was, recommended to the U.S. Department of Justice that they investigate David Ferry, the original focus of Jim Garrison's investigation. The legacy of America's political assassinations, including the assassination of Martin Luther King, I think is described very aptly by William F. Pepper in the conclusion to his book. He is talking here about the assassination of Martin Luther King, but I think the conclusion of his book aptly describes the state of America in 1995 after the wave of political assassinations that plagued this country. The author writes, "Now it may be too late. The corporate elite, their lawyers and bankers, as well as their assets and government who have led us into the abyss, may quite simply be too strong to dislodge, too powerful to unseat, at least in our lifetimes. We now appreciate, as never before, the power of the, quote, establishment, unquote. James Madison's worst fears appear to have been realized. He, the Republic's fourth president, the father of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution itself, warned about the very danger which has consumed our representative democracy. He noted that when any faction becomes so powerful, beyond its legitimate numerical presence, that it can dominate the branches of government and the political parties so that dissent is suppressed, then tyranny will thrive. The system of government which results is a democracy in name only. Under the Constitution of the United States, Madison and his founding colleagues attempted to provide for the problem by establishing a structure of government with a separation of powers so that theoretically the executive, legislative, and judicial branches may act as a check on the others. What was not envisioned, however, was that an increasingly powerful corporate elite would develop which would not only formulate and act upon common policies, values, and goals, but also lend its senior representatives to government service. The power and influence of this corporate faction extends across all branches of government into virtually every agency and department. Governmental policies and activities in the services of these powerful private economic interests have, where those interests required, continually lied and deceived the people as to the true state of events at home and abroad. Thus, the enormous power and wealth of the government has been used for purposes and ends which all too often have been directly contrary to the interests of the masses of Americans. With all of this history laid bare and the details of the abuse of power clearly revealed, the inevitable conclusion will still be very difficult for many Americans to accept. Representative democracy, as practiced in the United States, has failed." Indeed. We're almost out of time. I would recommend that people interested in following up on this information contact a tape duplication service called Archives on Audio, which has radio documentaries presenting the printed documentary sources upon which the lines of argument presented here are based on permanent file. Archives on Audio can be contacted by telephone at area code 415-346-1840. That's 415-346-1840. This concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.